Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Hi, and welcome to Everything is Fine, a podcast for women over 40. We are your hosts. I'm Kim France.
And I'm Jen Romolini.
And Jen, I turned 59 last week.
Fuck yes, Kim France. How was your birthday? Happy birthday.
Thank you. My birthday was pretty nice. It was a, you know, pretty chill. Well, it wasn't a chill day. We actually went into the city. Mm-hmm. I went in to try on the dress I will be wearing to get married in.
Oh my God. How do you feel in it?
It's, you know what? It's a tight dress. it's a tight dress. It's like I haven't worn anything that it adheres to my body in the longest time. And like, It's like, it's not tight, like in a sausage casing way. Right. It's just like, it's a snug dress. It's not meant to be diaphanous, and everything I wear, I want to be diaphanous at all times. So, or just, you know, shapeless.
Are you wearing Spanx? Are you going to wear Spanx on your wedding? Don't wear Spanx. You're going to hate wearing Spanx.
I'm going to wear Spanx. Fuck yes. Fuck yes. I'm going to wear Spanx. They're going to be pictures. They're going to be pictures. I know you think that makes me less feminist than I was a minute ago.
No, that is a lie and a half. I do not think that makes you in any way less feminist. I think it makes you more of a masochist than I would like you to be, because it's Spanx are the fucking worst. I just found a pair of Spanx in my drawer, and I was like, from my corporate days, and I was like, oh, fuck, Spanx.
You know, I've never had such a, I've had a more peaceful relationship to Spanx than you, it sounds like. But I actually, for this party, like it's, the dress is kind of just like a lace overlay. So it needs a slip underneath it.
Okay. Okay.
And the slip that I found is by Skims.
All right. I do like her. I do like that. I do like Skims, man. I do.
Skims, they make some nice things. And then I got from Spanx, I got the ones that are like shorts that look like they're wrestler shorts because they have the strap that goes over your shoulders.
No. Why?
Because it will flatten my stomach.
Oh, honey. But then but the thing is that the stomach is going to be the whole time like, why have you done this to me?
No. The stomach wouldn't do it like my feet are going to do it with whatever shoes I choose. Like I can handle a little Spanx. I can handle a little like discomfort in that area. But, you know, what I don't like is like when I'm wearing tights or something and they're digging into my, you know.
Yes, belly button. No, I went to the Emmys a couple of years ago through like Dove sent me to the Emmys. Okay. Like it was like, like that's the kind of, you know, the stupid like beauty company promotions. And my friend who I went with wore Spanx under her dress. And the whole time we were like, we were sitting in the, and we saw the whole show and she was just like, I'm dying. Cause you know, it's like the ones that cut you actually with the strap ones, it's better. The ones that cut at your belly button just cut right into your organs.
Oh yeah, it hurts.
At one point we were in the bathroom and I just saw them on the floor and she left them like they I was like, all right, well get rid of them.
Yeah, no, I get it. So yeah, in short, Spanx will be, you know, if not layers of Spanx. But yeah.
All right.
So that was part of the birthday. I went to go try on the dress. Paul waited in the car. Then we went to Grand Central Station, my favorite building in New York, and had lunch at the Oyster Bar.
Oh, nice.
Which I love. Mm-hmm. You know, I think in part because I only get there once or twice a year.
Yeah.
The food was fine. Then we went uptown to my mom's briefly. We had a full day. And then that night went out to dinner with my family to have Korean barbecue.
Fun.
And it was all in all, it was a good, but you know, I also believe in, have I discussed the concept of Princess Week on this podcast before?
Okay, you have, but I think everyone can use a refresher on Princess Week because I love Princess Week. And actually my husband now adopts Princess Week.
That for is his for own. Him?
Yes, for
That's
him.
That's hilarious. So my friend Kate, her parents divorced when she was very little. This was back when people still weren't getting divorces a lot and they felt really guilty about it and wanted to figure out a way to make her birthday as special as it had been when both her parents were in the same house. So they invented something called Princess Week, her parents did.
Right.
Where they would just give her presents and make her feel special and give her cake for an entire week.
It's amazing.
So I'm still in Princess Week.
Yeah. You are. You're in Princess Week, which is the time when money doesn't matter. You could just buy anything you want. You could do anything you want, go anywhere you want.
It's true. Princess Week could be pretty disastrous if I took it to its logical conclusion, but
yeah,
it ends before that can happen. But no, you know, I really haven't, I don't know how it'll be next year. 60 is an awfully big number, but I do feel like I'm kind of over getting bummed out on my birthday. Like,
good.
We'll see next year, but I just feel like, you know how I feel. I feel lucky to be here.
Yeah. No, I think that's so good. I think it's so good. And I think we should keep this energy going. I weirdly feel similarly. I'm turning 50 next week and I'm really like come to a peace with it. Like I really went through a lot of feelings about it and now I'm kind of psyched. I'm just like, well, what if I get to be exactly what I want to be in my 50s? Like, what if that happens? Like, fuck it. I'm kind of excited too.
Oh, my 50s were so much better than my 40s. Just so much better.
I mean, my 30s blew. My 50s have not been that great. I was thinking about where I was 10 years ago and I was like, oh God, I was like a corporate executive, like wearing Spanx. I've had several lives, I feel like, in this decade. So yeah, we'll see what happens. And speaking of several lives and several decades, we have an exciting guest today.
Yes, we do. Carlene Bauer.
This was an unofficial Everything is Fine book club for Carlene's book, Girls They Write Songs About, which I loved, you loved. You know, we created an international audience for Carlene Bauer's. I've gotten people write to me from like Sweden who are like, I love this book. Thanks for recommending it. Because it is like the quintessential Gen X friendship book, I felt.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book, really a wonderful book and very rigorous.
It's a lovely book. And anyway, so that's a treat. That interview with her is a treat. And before we get into that, just one housekeeping note. We do have a live event coming up April 9th, 4 p.m. I know it's Easter. I'm sorry. I thought Easter was a morning thing. Everyone who's been... everyone, like, I'm Catholic. I didn't expect you to know, but I'm Catholic. I thought Easter was a morning thing, you know, church, bunny hop, and then, you know, you can hang out with us and have a hard kombucha at 4 p.m. But anyway, yes, we're having an Easter show April 9th at Caveat. And again, Caveat NYC. The link is in the show notes if you want to see us live in person in New York. If not, we are also doing a live stream, and the live stream is not only live in that moment, but will be available for 7 days. So if you're on a different time zone, which people have also emailed me about, if you're on a different time zone, you can also see it later at your convenience for 1 week.
And if you're in New York, come to the live event, because I think it will be really fun to meet you guys.
I think it will. I'm considering it to be my birthday party. So I'm not having a big birthday party. So I'm considering this live event to be a birthday party. And I also want us to take the crew down and get drinks afterwards. And, you know, TBD, what sequined outfit I'm going to be wearing. So
absolutely. The fact that you've upped the ante on what your own wardrobe for this event has me very anxious. I have no idea what I'm going to wear.
You know what? The thing is, I will totally back down and be like, let's just match.
That would be so good. Maybe we should match. That would be awesome.
Just identical outfits, like head to toe. Oh my God. All right. Well, let's get into this episode. Our guest today is Carlene Bauer. Carlene is the author of the memoir, Not That Kind of Girl, the 2013 novel, Frances and Bernard, and most recently, the novel, Girls They Write Songs About, or as I like to call it, the only 2022 book that matters. Carlene earned an MA in nonfiction writing from Johns Hopkins University's writing seminars and has worked in and around New York publishing for decades. Her work has been published in The Village Voice, Salon, Elle, The New York Times Magazine, and on the website of N+1. Welcome, Carlene. Hello. Hi.
Hi. I'm so glad to be here.
Okay, so I'm just going to get it out there. I think we're all nervous. I'm really nervous to talk to you because I loved your book so much. And it's only after months after reading it that I can actually talk to you, because before that, I was mad at you for writing such a good book.
That is how I know I did my job, because I've had other writers, like when I've talked to other writers, like when they say, like, I was so mad you wrote that book, or that's how you know you won, or you did what you set out to do, and you make other writers jealous.
Totally. I was, you know. No, it's fine. You wrote a remarkable book. So let's just start off with Girls They Write Songs About. How did it start out? Like, what happened?
that's the question. What happened? I had watched my friendships, not all of them, but some friendships and friendships of people I was close to and not close to, play out in such a way as we all progressed into and deeper into our 40s. And some of the tensions started to happen around like our late 30s too. And I wanted to try to see if I could delineate those tensions and fallouts between people. And a lot of it had to do with like a sibling rivalry that can spring up between women.
Yeah.
A really good friend of mine once said, like, we were talking about a situation in which, like, there was a have and have not situation playing out between friends that she knew. And she said, women's friendships cannot withstand that kind of inequality. And I thought, yes, that's it. And I thought, you should have written my book. But that is true. And I've thought that's partly why I wrote the book, just try to get at what is it when one of you has something or many things and the other does not. And the way the friendship can start to crumble when the foundations that you had, the formed it in your youth, start to dissipate. And it's sort of like the person you dream with cannot be the person who's judging you. And at a certain point in friendships, as you get deeper into life, you can start to judge each other rather than dream with each other. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted to try to capture. And also maybe to write about female envy and not in a way that turns into a Devil Wears Prada. Like, I think there are so many things we write about female experience that is not true to female experience. And envy is one of them. It doesn't have to be soap operatic. It can be really painful to harbor these feelings about someone who you desperately needed to live.
Right.
You know, you needed this person in your life to help you achieve what you wanted to achieve. But once you start losing your footing, because again, like someone has something you don't, you have something they don't, then it all falls apart and you have to separate or somebody recuses themselves. And it's deeply sad. Like I still go on grieving friendships that I, lost to this kind, like whether I felt that way and couldn't do it anymore, or whether they felt that way and they couldn't do it anymore. And often I think people don't say why it is that they're leaving.
Of course, that's part of what the book is about envy.
And competition. I mean,
competition for sure. But the money thing, we don't talk about that a lot. We get into different books about class, but that specific kind of like, oh, you both wanted the same thing and one of you got it.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Or more than the other, or what you got more than the other.
Yeah.
Or when you switch, so one of you, like you both might have started out not wanting money, but as time goes on, you see that maybe one of you cares about it more than that other person may actually admit to themselves. And again, none of this is dastardly. Like the unspoken sort of watching each other, and especially in New York.
Yes.
Oh, and I wanted to say the other thing that made me write the books is watching Elena Ferrante become a phenomenon. And I loved those books. I loved it. And I loved them so much that I have not read the fourth because I did not want that universe and story to end. And I thought, what if I tried to write, because those books are so passionate and they make so much out of very ordinary things. And I thought, what if I could try to do that in a middle class to upper middle class American version? Like, could I make people feel that as much as we all felt for that world?
Did you, it seems to me, because I really miss the 90s in New York. Like I used to say, like, I wanted to start a Tumblr called I Preferred the 90s because I just did. But it seems to me that we share this.
That is, I guess, one thing I did want to see if I could capture and to do it in a way that wasn't disturbingly nostalgic.
Yeah.
And I came to New York in 1997. So I was, even when I arrived here, like I was aware that like all the things that happened before I got here, like in a way that I didn't think it was dead, but I was very aware that most of the dirt had been cleaned up.
Yes.
And that I could walk around, luckily, like I could walk around and feel safe.
Yes.
Safe enough. And could afford it, you know. Now I would say it might be dead. And I always try to be like, is it dead? I talk with my boyfriend who's been here longer than I have. Like, you know, so I've been here 25 years. He's been here longer. But like, is it dead? Are we old or is it dead? No, it seems dead. It's like music too. Like, is this bad or are we just old?
That's so funny.
So there's so many things to miss about the 90s. And I often have to, I want to interrogate always, because I'm a 90s child, I have to interrogate my own responses.
Right.
What is it that I miss when I miss it? And I think a lot of it has to do with a certain kind of freedom. And the longer we live in the sort of culture we do, I think what I really miss is an intellectual and psychological freedom that I think is gone. And I can't say I miss the clothes because they're everywhere now.
Right.
You know, the thing about New York is that I think maybe I wanted to try to get at the last gasp of a New York that had grit in its grandeur. Like you need both to have New York be great. You need to have the skyscrapers and the hot dog carts.
Right.
And like that tension is what makes it so magical. And when you have too much of one and too much of the other, the magic's not there.
I also feel like the 90s were the last time you could say to somebody, I'll meet you on the corner of 13th and 7th at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. See you there.
I know. It really did encourage personal responsibility.
and intimacy with other people in a different way, like palpable intimacy.
I think that's true. And another thing I wanted to try to get at with a book, like, and the 90s might have been, I mean, this definitely seems to have been the case, the last gasp of a certain sort of office culture.
Yes.
And again, like, this was another situation where, like, walking to an office in New York in the late 90s, I knew that, like, all the parties had been had. Like, it was, you know, I was just, like, walking through the embers.
But doesn't everybody feel that way a little?
I do. But again, it's one of those things where, like, maybe something did die and I was at its funeral. You could be collegial and, you know, just being around people. And if you were lucky, and I was lucky several times over, and I feel like I shouldn't even talk about it, I was lucky enough to be at offices which were publishers and magazines. And I was young, or I shielded myself because I did fact checking so that I knew I was recusing myself from a certain level of insanity, and pain, but I liked the people I worked with and they liked me.
Yeah.
And so when you're lucky enough to have that cocktail going on, the office can seem like a magical, magical place, like a crucible for being. And I think that I wanted to try to get at that.
We worked in a field where the line between business and pleasure was very thin.
No, that's it, Kim. Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah. You know, I wonder, because this was something I thought you got really right, was publishing office culture in that time. So, I mean, I came to New York in 2000, so I'm a couple years late, but it's around the same time. I was also a fact checker, you know, the whole thing. So I saw every single thing that was happening. Like I felt it, right? And you get so many details precisely right, like almost too many to talk about, but particularly the relationship between a writer and editor. There's a moment where Charlotte's editing Rose that I was just like, oh my God, I remember those moments. But you also, this disillusionment of having gone through the publishing grinder, like you play that out over a long period of time in the book. And it feels like you really felt that. Like, you're saying that you had nice jobs, but did you have unhappy jobs in publishing? Because I'm fucking assuming you did, because I did.
I mean, yes, I was frustrated within my, I could get very frustrated. But I think the frustration was, as the kids used to say, an inside job. I mean, the kids never said that, that was older people. But I think that was me not being grateful. Or it was me not knowing how to make something great out of what I had been given.
It makes sense. I felt like for me, and this might not be your experience, I felt like the dream was not worthy of the dreamer. Like I got in and I was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Like people were disappointing and publishing was like, publishing was in a dive. I mean, it was like, you know.
I think I didn't make enough of what I had been privy to. That's just me.
Oh, interesting.
I was raised evangelical and I come from a certain sort of, anyway, but I mean, not that, you know what? I can't even blame it on church. I can't even blame that on.
Wait, so what would you have done differently? What, how, where did you not show up?
No, like been not me, like been born to entirely different people, which is actually like, things I can't change. Like I can't, I wish I had been braver. I wish I had pitched more. I wish I had taken myself more seriously over and over and over again. And the amount of time that I spent not taking myself, that's what I really regret.
Interesting.
And also, I also regret, you know, not wearing a bikini more often too. So it's like those two things, like I regret not sleep. I shouldn't say that anyway, but I regret a lot. I regret much. So like
but,
that.
But you wrote a perfect book. You wrote a perfect book. So doesn't it equal out in the end?
Yeah, now, some of the things I've been talking about right now, which, you know, I am now old enough. I'll just say it. I am 50 years old. I just turned 50. And I'm an Aquarius, if anyone's asking, with deep Capricorn energies. Can you feel it? And I, now that I'm older, I have mostly come to grips to all the things I've just been talking about in the last minute or so. But I do feel proud of this book. And I do feel that things are mostly evening out.
So what is your relationship to ambition like now? Like you mentioned how much you felt like you won when people told you that they were jealous that you wrote that book and they were mad at you.
I heard Fran Lebovitz, somebody was quoting her online, and she said something like, most people shouldn't be writing. If you ever do feel the need to write, eat something sweet and see if the feeling passes. Oh my God. Like, would Fran Lebovitz say that I deserve to write? Because I was thinking like, I could eat a whole bag of Cheetos and still like think that I need to make people forget Sheila Hattie ever existed. I mean, no, I'm still really ambitious. Thank you for asking that, Kim. That seems to not die. Like even as I get sort of older and the fire is just a little bit dampened enough for me to proceed with grace and patience in a way that I didn't have before. But I definitely like it. It feels like that's what defines me. It is a driving thing. Like I didn't really want to have kids, and this was what I wanted to do. So, and I've done it mostly.
Was turning 50 a thing for you? Jen is turning 50 next week, by the way.
I will be 50 by the time this comes out. Yes. Hi, we're exactly the same age, which is intense.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you.
Thank you. I think the 40s were the difficult third album. I think that's a friend of mine who referred to my book that way, the difficult third album. like a deep, like we reviewed records, and I think, and I know Kim, oh, that's such a Gen X thing to say, the difficult third record. You know, this is very strange to say out loud, but I feel like maybe I can say this in this forum. My father just passed away, and
sorry.
Yeah.
Thanks. But that actually was more of a like turning point than the age, I think. So I think it's just incumbent upon me to use whatever term I have left to like make good on what the 25-year-old and 16-year-old wanted. And I hope I don't sound too optimistic.
No,
not at all.
Actually, it's inspiring because we're usually such dark bitches. So this is actually very inspiring.
So am I.
You're in a good mood today. So let's like go with it. So
what I think about this a lot. Like I can say it's now or never. I must make good on fill in the blank. But you know, the culture is going to put you in a, you know, like some of what I want to realize is culture dependent.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Or it won't be. It depends. And I think that's the shit of being this age. Pardon my French I'm just sort of arriving into this is, you know, it seems to me that you're just learning how to be who you are and you're just learning. You've just gotten perspective. You feel like you know exactly all the ways in which you're smart and capable and powerful and nobody gives a shit. Like that's what it seems like. It might be that way that nobody wants to hear it from you.
I think that we create our own reality to some degree. Like I feel like when I was 25, I thought I was smart and capable and like nobody gave a shit. And like, I feel like it's the kind of the same.
No, right.
I mean, I have mixed feelings about that because when you said it, it really, really resonated with me. You know, there is a kind of power that you feel and a kind of, you know, settledness that you feel. And it can be really exhilarating. And at the same time, we're not young and cute anymore.
I know.
You know, and the fact, I mean, I thought I was clever all those years. I was just cute.
No, come on. No. No.
I wasn't that cute. I guess I'm really giving.
Oh my God.
To do what you've done, you must have been. Do you know what I like? But this is.
She was. This is ridiculous. Let's take a quick break from some ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
And we're back.
I don't know what you two think about this, but I think a lot, being from the 90s, I think a lot about PJ Harvey, Courtney Love. Women of our generation gave the world these, I mean, at least two, like you could put Sleater Kinney in there, although those two women came out of their 20s sounding like ancient crones in the best possible way. And we gave the world that in our 20s, when we were barely in our 20s or somewhere in our 20s. And I often think, what could be a Gen X version of that for, like, could we give that to the world again? Like, where that, the energy, because those songs to me, like, they're timeless. Young people made them and they're timeless. Like, what is it, like, now that we're, have all this wisdom, what could we give a very loud, steadying wisdom? What can we give to other people. Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that was actually something.
Well, books like yours.
Yeah. Books like, and that was a question I wanted to ask you because, you know, we are exactly the same age. We're very, very in the middle of Gen X. Both of us were very strongly Gen X. And this felt like such a Gen X girl book to me, like just so much. And I was wondering, like, were you aware of the broader strokes of this generation? Like, were there themes you were really trying to hit in this about Gen X? Because it felt like there were some like second, you know, the feminism you got into, yeah, how it failed us, what the expectation of that. So I'm just wondering if you were grappling with that when you were writing it.
Yes. I wanted to see if I could record how it was to live through certain ideas and moments, but not to do it in a heavy-handed way,
yeah,
like a class portrait. But also anybody who wasn't that age, I wanted them to be able to see themselves in it too. So a former professor of mine, she's like almost 70 and she really loved it. And I was a little nervous, but she loved it. And that meant a lot to me. And I've heard younger women say that it like they really loved it too. So I wanted it to be welcoming to anybody who saw themselves in it. And there have been men who really loved it too. And I always sort of feel relieved when I write a book and men are like, this was amazing, which is crazy, but that's the way we live, or the head I live in. And no, I wanted to, yeah, I did want to do what you said. Yes.
And you did without hitting you over the head with it. You absolutely did. I mean, it's, and you also got into a lot of things about class that I have not really seen that really resonated with me. You know, particularly going from working class into sort of white collar jobs, like making mm-hmm. that class jump and feeling like a fish out of water in so many ways and just being like, oh, well, all these people came from something different, clearly, you know?
Yeah,
was that real life to you? Is that, yes. Is that autobiographical? Okay.
Yes. My parents didn't go to college, and what I sort of wanted to memorialize was that kind of strata of New York where nobody in your family wanted this, but you did. So I technically am a first generation college. I think I was like the first person in my family, both sides, to graduate from college, I think.
Yep.
And it didn't really start to bother me until my 30s. I felt like America was a meritocracy, idiot. And, but the more I knew, I'm like, oh, like going to Harvard does help. like, why did I? Oh, that's
harsh. Parents who can put a down payment on your house, it helps a lot.
No. Yes.
Parents who can finance your unpaid internship.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But the book publishing that I worked in, like everybody, all the assistants I knew, like they went to NYU, like they came from Indiana. Like, as far as I could tell, they were paying their own bills. And yeah. I feel like people don't talk about that enough, is that because all the people I knew in publishing, like nobody's parents were giving them a credit card. And, but again, we were lucky enough to live in a New York where you could still, you know, you could still kind of get by without needing a lot of money, I guess.
I think something that I was impressed by in this book is how you deal with Charlotte and Rose's sex lives.
Oh, uh-huh.
Which I think is very unapologetically. They don't always make themselves the most likable.
Could you say more about that?
Just that they're, you know, there is sleeping with married men.
Yeah.
And it is, I mean, I had so many feelings about that. I thought it was amazing that you didn't judge for that. But I also thought there was something kind of depressing about it because it's like, they all cheat.
Yeah.
They all cheat.
Oh, meaning the married men or everybody?
Meaning the married men, yeah.
Well, my experience was that I saw women doing certain things that I had been acculturated to expect of men. And I think many of us, you know, you get to New York and you think like the classic cheater, and I want to be very careful, the classic cheater is like a, what we would now call a finance bro.
Right.
But as time went on, I saw that no, men were the ones sort of sitting at home while the women were out. Like, wow. And I thought that's interesting because no one talked about that in the texts I have read for my pleasure and in school. I feel there are so many other female writers, you know, they seem to be younger or not. Actually, I don't even know if that's true, but seem to be braver about writing about sex And I wish that I had been braver about it or more erotic about it, but who needs that? I feel like everybody's caught up. Like maybe what's more interesting to write about is the power dynamics.
Well, but also about I think what you really got at in this book was that it was less about desire than about being desired.
Right.
Being a girl they write songs about.
Yeah. And that felt very true to me. That felt very, very real. And I remember that. I remember how it felt to be in that skin, you know, to be desired and how hungry I was to be desired. I wasn't really thinking about, is this good sex? What's my pleasure in this? What's that? Who gives a shit? I didn't care. It was more about acquisition. It was not about, you know.
That is it. And, you know, like how much of that is New York? And like whatever drug New York is giving me, I'm cool with it. That's fine. Whatever it's doing to amp up what's already in me, that's fine. Like that is really like, is it me making me acquisitive sexually? Is there New York making me acquisitive sexually? Or is it both? Does it matter? And I think for a certain sort of woman, if you don't early on learn that you're desirable, you will be forever, well, right now, this second, wondering like, am I desirable?
Yep. No, you're onto something. And we've discussed this with other women of our generation when we had that conversation with Sari about always chasing that sort of feeling of like, oh, I'm wanted. Like, cause we were in, think of the messaging we got. Like, of course we were insecure. Like,
well, no, I mean, we grew up on different ad campaigns, but right. I'm thinking about the Love's Baby sauce.
Yeah. I remember that. I remember that ad.
Wait, I loved that scent. Remind me, Kim, of the ads around that. Was it like soft focus, like pink light bulb kind of?
Okay, yes. So the name of this campaign was You Can Try Hard or You Can Try Soft. And it's like, you can try, and the song goes, you can try hard. And there's a girl who's really brassy looking in a convertible and she stops her car really fast to like check out the guy, and the guy's not into it. And they go, or you can try soft. And it's like a curly haired girl, probably Jane Modine, like riding a bicycle with a puppy in the basket.
No.
Soft will make his love light shine. Love's baby soft.
No, sorry.
Good. I didn't feel like I was contributing anything to this podcast today, but now I feel
Are
like
you
I
kidding?
Am.
You're, oh. No, oh we were God. Built to be muses. Like that's, if you think about all the songs we grew up with, it was always like the lady is a muse, you know, like the best thing could be to be a muse in some ways, but also to bring home the bacon and fry it up for a man.
The Anjali commercial, like
the Anjali, just never forget it.
Was advertising, like they wrote a song that you will remember even when you're on a vent alert, like that's in the hospital. But I think, you know, I felt, well, it's like two things, like 80s, 90s. So like in the 80s, you're like, I'm too fat. And then, you know, in the 90s, it was like, I'm not bitchy enough. So it's like, you get it. Now I feel like, but I actually don't feel this anymore. There was a sort of a crease around, I don't know, like 3 years ago. I feel like, oh, wait, in the 90s, I was like, oh, I respect Bikini Kill, but they're too angry. Can I say that? Like, they are geniuses, but my anger isn't that anger. Like, is that okay? It's not okay. I must not really be a feminist. And then, you know, then a couple of years ago with younger feminists, like being angry or not younger, but I feminism taking up anger again, I felt like, oh my God, I'm not angry enough. I thought I was done with this. I felt like when I got to New York, I felt like the second wave has commanded me to have as much sex as I, ah! And then I had this line in the book, but like I took it out. But like, I don't remember any, Simone de Beauvoir didn't say in the second sex, have sex with whoever you want. But Simone de Beauvoir herself. So there were these. So the texts may not have, explicitly commanded it, but the lives of the people writing the texts commanded you to do this. So it wasn't. So by the time I got to New York, and like even in, you know, like even in college too, like I sort of like, I am not like, let's get one thing clear. Like, I am not your muse, but I was also timid in my way. So there was the tension between understanding that one can have these things, but then the individual you are, can you get those things? And maybe that tension, I hope that tension shows up in the book.
It totally does. But I do think that led to that, all of that ideology, all of that conditioning led to a lot of performative sluttiness.
I think this still goes on.
Oh, absolutely.
And to see how that problem keeps happening without getting, quote unquote, solved. Does it need to be solved? Like, we all learn things in our own time. Like, but that, I think, I shouldn't say that, but like the prevalence of kink, like even in ads, I'm like, that's more pressure on people.
Yeah.
We were just talking about this. Yes.
When I see that word on the internet, on a Subway ad, I think, pity the poor young person who has to experience living in the gap between this made-up ideal and the person they are. And until we solve for that gap, which we never will, because I don't think, we will still go on experiencing pain around sex. And the lies we are complicit in around sex, I think, are really... it's like the only way we have to measure a person's braveness. It's like we simultaneously want it to mean nothing at all, but yet we use it as the only reliable measurement of how strong a person you are. Will you do this sex thing? I'm sorry. So it's
interesting.
So I think that you can have an extremely liberated class of young people, you know, I think we thought that we were, you know, at the cutting edge of, you know, but the tension between what your culture asks you to do and what you, the individual, feel prepared to do is very different. That's why I tried to write, I mean, this book doesn't speak to that, but there's,
right.
What I want to try to get at is that tension between what you understand your culture to be asking you to do, and I didn't do it completely in the book, and what you, the individual, actually feels like as a human in your body, in your mind.
Right.
I mean, this is such a deep and rich topic. Christine Emba wrote a whole book called Rethinking Sex about from the 60s to today. And it's really good. And like one of the things, like I've interviewed someone recently who was saying, like, because this has been going on, you know, at least since the sexual revolution, at least since Fear of Flying,
yes.
Like, right?
Yeah.
The idea of what we're supposed to be is not caught up to how we actually feel. And one of the women I interviewed from the 70s was like, the only thing you couldn't be in the 70s was a person who wanted to be in a monogamous relationship with a man.
No, right.
Like that was so uncool to be that. And I think it's interesting though. I do think that this generation, generation now, Gen Z, at least trying to think about who they authentically are, their identities, and what they want, and talking to each other about sex, and there's much more idea of consent. So I do think there's been progress. It's just never that much.
No, right.
But I mean, I think it would be like, I was such a naive kid. I was so late to everything sexual. Like, it would be hard for me if I was a kid. I mean, I think that there must be a lot of pressure to be like down with what your program is now at a very young age.
I do have a soft spot in my heart for the late bloomer, because I think there's a certain sort of, there can be pain around it.
But wait, let's talk about childlessness a little bit, right? Because that's something you super explore in the book. And it's something I think you said earlier, you knew you didn't want to do. And that's was for a woman of our generation, a really bold stance. Did you always know that? How did you grapple with that?
I think I knew from probably around like 7 or 8 that I wanted to go out into the world and work and do something. And I knew that I wanted to be an artist of some kind. Yeah, I think it got harder. I mean, and I say this in the book, like I felt very, you know, like I had no ambivalence about my decision to not do that, not have kids. Like I thought I was going to have a very fulfilling life. I was going to fill it up with all kinds of things. My work would fill me. I would be an amazing writer and be, if not famous, then well-respected in a way that got me out of the house a lot. And once I got into my 30s and you see people like having kids, you're like, should I have done this? And so what was happening was that people were having children at the same time that I was questioning, like, was I right to have put all my eggs in this basket? Like the writing thing isn't working out quite the way I wanted it to. And then you start to look at what other people have and think I should have done that. That seems like a much easier and quicker route to self-fulfillment and figuring out what your reason for living is if you have small people around you and a husband or a partner. And that's when I started to wonder, maybe I had been stupid to not want that. And I think that often with childlessness, and I could be wrong about this, but I feel like you have to be really, it's like, sort of with abortion too, which like you have to be really, you have to denounce. With childlessness, I think you have to come down really hard on not wanting kids. I feel like there's a certain sort of rhetoric around it.
Yeah.
But I feel I regret it sometimes.
Yeah.
Because it also took me this long to realize that maybe I could have been a good mother and I would have really loved it.
You know, I'm childless, not entirely by choice. As the years have gone by, I've begun to realize that it actually was a choice. Like it could have happened. I didn't. And that I actually, like, as I get older, I used to feel like the hole was getting bigger or that those feelings were. And now I feel like, no, it's actually contracting again.
Right. Did it? I feel like that might be happening. Do you know, is there a number of years, Kim, you can talk about the contracting?
I'm 59. I just turned 59. So I would say that, yeah, my 30s were very, I was still married in my 30s and children were a possibility. Then I got divorced and I just knew I didn't want to do it alone. And those were very hard years in my 40s because I was very aware. My friends had kids late, so I had a lot of friends with small children. I was acutely aware of what I didn't have. And like, you know, what you were saying earlier is really true, although you didn't use these words, but like, having children slaps a meaning onto your life, right? Whether you want it or not. And if you don't have children, you can become convinced that that's the only route to a certain kind of meaning, a certain kind of selflessness, you know? And I used to always tell the story about my brother being in Paris at the same time as my brother, and he had small children, one of whom wanted to go to the top of the Eiffel Tower. So he waited for 4 hours in line. And I was like, that's just a kind of reflexive selflessness that you don't have if you don't have children. You can be really selfish if you don't have children. And more than one person has said to me, like, you can be really selfish and be a parent.
I wouldn't have waited in that fucking line. There's no way. I would have been like, we're coming back at midnight. And that's actually what I did. I was like, see it at night, kid.
I always like grab onto stories that I hear of like parental non-selflessness or like parental, like if I hear about parents who are still doing X, Y, like doing the things you imagine parenthood would dissolve, like they're still doing it. Like I hoard them because I feel like, oh good. Like you can be a flawed person with or without children. Like there, and I think if you don't have children, you can put this burden on yourself of thinking just what you said, Kim, like somehow it creates selflessness that you don't already have.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think we get to a certain age and we look back over the sort of map of our lives and we're like, oh, I kind of regret that turn and I regret that one. And it doesn't matter what you did. Like you regret marriages, you regret having children, even if you love them. Like we don't talk about that shit enough. And I've said it on the podcast a million times that motherhood is a scam. I adore my child, like could not love them more. I am so excited that they are in the world. Raising them is a huge pain in the ass. And it's just the truth. Like, and I don't know why more people don't talk about it, or maybe more other people are better suited to it than I am, but I'm good at it. And I'm aware of that.
See, but I'll never believe it doesn't change you foundationally.
It doesn't. I'm here to tell you as a person who like snuck out last night after being so frustrated, I'm 50 years old and I snuck out to smoke weed to run away from my child. It never changes.
That's hilarious.
I mean, there was a person in the house, but like, I wasn't like abandoning, but I was like, God, I'm a teenager. You know what I mean? It doesn't change.
Have you seen any quote unquote representations in the culture of that kind of, I mean, like, I guess I could think of them like of that show that motherhood is a scam? I mean, I can't even believe I have to ask this. I should know this myself.
I mean, Better Things gets at it. Better Things gets at it perfectly. Like you love them. You're there for them. You could not want to show up more. You're so happy they're alive and they treat you like shit.
You're reminding me another reason why I didn't have them. It seemed like so futile to give birth to something that would hate you from maybe year 12 to, I don't know, 80? Yeah. Who can say? And that, I think I just wanted to avoid that altogether. You can hate them just because you're a small human, not because of anything they're doing.
No, the other day my kid said, I hate you over something because I was setting a boundary around some rule or some discipline bullshit. And I was like, I don't expect you to like me. Like,
Yeah.
I'm not here for that.
Jen, I might not have had the cojones to live in that World War I trench.
I know, I'd be like, she hates me, they hate me, he hates me.
And now that I'm like, I'm, you know, 50, like I feel like I could occupy that space and not care that someone in my small space hates me. Go with God.
The other thing we don't talk about is that there is a narcissism in parenting that we don't talk about enough, right? And especially in the age of social media, everyone's just showing you these, like, it's just, I can't imagine to not, because I look at these pictures people show on social media and I was like, I know the truth because I have one and I know the truth. But to people who don't have kids, you must be like, oh, that looks so nice and cozy.
No, I try not to watch TikTok ever, but one of my favorite TikTok videos genres is the toddler learning to say words. I could watch toddlers learning to say words forever.
No, one of the things I wish that I had had a child in order to be like at the science experiment years, like, oh, it's a human. Yeah. Learning how to be human. Fascinating. It doesn't hate me yet.
Yes. Those years are good. But but wanting that is like being like, I really love kittens. And in 5 months, you're going to have a giant fat cat. Like, it's like,
I was just going to ask you, what is it that you still want to do?
I want to write more books until I drop dead. Like, I think like that's, and be a good daughter and be a good partner and be a good friend. And I want to go to Japan. I don't know what like things I haven't done.
No, I want to go to Japan.
Well, but have you been ever?
I've never been. And I could have gone in the Condé Nast years. I could have gone on their dime.
Oh.
It's one of my, like, if you want to talk about like major regrets that I can like torture myself with, like the free trip to Japan, like done really nice, never happened. Well, thank you for doing this. This has been amazing.
We could talk to you. I feel like we could talk to you for like 3 more hours.
I feel the same way about you both, but I don't. And I mean that sincerely. And I am so grateful that you both asked me on. And this felt like something more than an interview. And that's a testament to you both. I would love to talk to you again, but I also, I just understand how life works. So
we want to be your friend. Totally. Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, we're forcing you. This is the first step in friendship. That's what we do.
Is that what happens when people come?
Yeah. We're like, who do you want to be friends with? Let's call them up, have them on.
A couple episodes, you were both talking about loneliness in a way that really spoke to me. And I would love to have drinks with you both. But like, again, like, I don't want to sound like an 18-year-old kid who doesn't understand how the world works.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Jen's going to be in New York.
We're doing a live show in like a couple weeks.
Oh, where?
Yeah, April 9th at Caveat NYC. We're doing on Clinton Street. We're coming in and then we're going to all have drinks at a bar is my plan.
Oh my God. Well, I'll come to that.
Carlene, you've been a delight. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah.
I'm really embarrassed. I got to get out of here because this is so great. But thank you both.
Thanks for listening to Everything is Fine. We are your hosts. I'm Jen Romolini.
And I'm Kim France.
If you like the show, please rate and review it on all the platforms. It really makes a difference, especially on Apple Podcasts. If you want to support the production of the show, help us keep the lights on, go to patreon.com/everythingisfine. We do live events there sometimes. We blog there sometimes. It's just to help us pay for production. If you want to follow us on social media, we are at EIF Podcast on Instagram. We're on Facebook with a private and robust Facebook group. We're on LinkedIn. We're on Twitter. If you want to email us with any feedback, you can email us at everythingisfinethepodcast@gmail.com. I think that's right. You can find Kim on her blog, girlsofacertainage.com. You can find me on tinyletter.com/Jennifer Romolini. The show is mixed and edited as usual by the great Natalie Rivera. Thank you, Natalie. And we'll be back next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.